firefight in the occupied Al-Quds Israeli forces kill a Palestinian in a shooting that leaves one Israeli dead and two soldiers wounded. Is an end in sight to Sudan's political crisis? That question as military rulers agree to reinstate the ousted prime minister after weeks of protests. And unrest in several U.S. cities over the acquittal of a white vigilante who killed two people during last year's anti-racism rallies. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gizumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Israeli forces shot dead a Palestinian in the old city of Al-Quds. The Israeli military is alleging that two Palestinians approached one of the gates of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. One of them then opened fire, killing an Israeli settler and wounding three people, including two Israeli officers. The military says its forces immediately fired back and killed the Palestinian on the spot. The other Palestinian reportedly escaped. Palestinian resistance fronts are now reacting to the development, pouring praise for the move, calling for the struggle against occupation to continue. Hamas says such operations are a natural response to the Israeli regime's growing crimes against Palestinians. A similar incident happened in the same area days ago. For more on that, we will be talking to our correspondent Mona Kandel, who is joining us live from Ramallah, and also Moti Abu Musabeh, political activist, who's joining us live from Gaza. Let's begin with our correspondent Mona. If you could please tell us more details about this particular incident.
Well, the identity of this Palestinian man is known now. Fadi Abu Shaydem, 42 years old, from the refugee camp of Shafat in occupied Al-Quds. What happened this morning is that this Palestinian man arrived at the Bab al-Silsila, one of the gates of Al-Aqsa Mosque, and he opened fire at Israeli soldiers there. According to the Israeli military reports, one Israeli settler was killed. Three others were wounded. Two of them are Israeli police officers. Other soldiers in the area immediately responded and opened fire, killing Fadi Abu Shaydem on the spot. According to the reports, also another Palestinian man was with Fadi Abu Shaydem. However, he succeeded to escape from the area. Israeli forces immediately closed the area there. People are not allowed to enter to the Al-Aqsa Mosque or the old town of Al-Quds, with more Israeli soldiers were called to the area. Now, Palestinian resistance groups and other Palestinian groups have praised this operation. Both Hamas and Jihad resistance groups said it's a normal response from Palestinians, especially in reaction to the ongoing crimes committed by the Israeli forces, not only in Al-Quds, but also across the occupied West Bank. Also, Hamas movement, in its statement, said that Fadi Abu Shaydem is one of its leaders in Shafat refugee camp. And now we are receiving that Israeli forces are on their way to the refugee camp of Shafat. It seems that they are planning to destroy the Fadi Abu Shaydem.
Thank you very much for your detailed explanation. Now let's talk to Mr. Musabeh. Mr. Musabeh, what does this signify? And especially we've seen a Palestinian resistance group throw their support at these Palestinians.
Yes, first of all, thanks for having me. In fact, as the your correspondent has mentioned that this act actually comes in the context of the normal response of the Palestinian people to the ongoing and non-stop Israeli practices and crimes committed on a daily basis against the Palestinian people. I think that it has become a matter of fact that Israeli occupation forces works by leaps and bounds trying to benefit from the international silence and the normalization agreements signed with the Arab regimes in order to keep forward, moving forward and keep going forward in creating a new de facto, especially when it comes to Jerusalem city. Israel tries to Judaize the Palestinian city and to create a new de facto on the ground. So we have seen Israel intensify its practices and its crimes. The Palestinian neighborhoods, especially Sheikh Jarrah, are under the ethnic cleansing, and the Palestinians that are actually on a recurring matter under the shooting and under the assaults of the Israeli settlers. And we have seen recently that Israel worked to turn the Palestinian cemeteries in Jerusalem into biblical gardens. So Israel works by leaps and bounds to change the realities on the ground. And we can say Palestinian people have no choice but to resist the Israeli occupation and to respond to the ongoing and non-stop Israeli crimes, especially amid the silence of the international community and amid the normalization agreements, because the Palestinian people practice the legitimate right of defending themselves, and no one can blame the Palestinian people to defend themselves in response to the ongoing and continuous Israeli crimes and assaults.
Thank you very much. That's an interesting point you raised. Mona Kandel, if you could please respond to that with the growing atrocities from the part of Israelis. Is there any other choice left for Palestinians?
Well, Israeli crimes and atrocities have never come to an end. Everything is raided, West Bank areas, villages, cities, areas in occupied Al-Quds on a daily basis. They arrest Palestinians, and a number of Palestinians had been killed during peaceful demonstrations and protests against the illegal settlements and against the separation wall. So the Israeli forces continue their crimes, killing people, unarmed people, peaceful people, and it seems, according to experts, as they continue to say, Palestinians are fed up. They have the right to defend themselves, to defend their homes and lands, to defend also their children in order not to be arrested. Children under the age of 10 are being arrested in Al-Quds without any legal basis. People are not supposed not to be detained by the Israeli forces when we speak about minors and children. So what he did, the Palestinian martyr, according to the Palestinian groups, and there's also a reaction from the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, saying it's a normal response as well. Now, Israeli Minister of Internal Security, Omer Barlev, said that they know Fadi Abu Shaydem was a member of Hamas movement in East Al-Quds. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett ordered security beefed up around Al-Quds as well as in all the areas leading to the holy city of Al-Quds. That was our correspondent, Mona Kandel, doing this live from Ramallah, and Mr. Moti Abu Mosabeh, political activist, who joined us live from Gaza City. Now, moving on. A major development unfolding in Sudan's politics. The military is to reinstate ousted Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok following an agreement reached with civilian leaders. The National Umma Party says that Hamdok will form a cabinet of technocrats
and that all political detainees will be released, but Sudan's main civilian opposition coalition says it does not recognize any political agreement with the military and is encouraging anti-coup demonstrators to continue. The developments come on the heels of weeks-long protests to demand the return of a civilian government. The country plunged into chaos after top general Abdel Fattah al-Burhan toppled the transitional government late last month and detained civilian leaders, including the prime minister. At least 40 anti-coup protesters have been killed since then. And political commentator Mujan Al-Niyal says anti-coup protesters in Sudan are demanding a lot more than simply the return of ousted Prime Minister Hamdok. She believes that it is time for the military to stop its interference in politics.
And we are starting to hear rumors about the return of the Prime Minister early last evening. As early as the rumors were heard, we saw statements and social media posts from resistance committees assuring the public that regardless of this, whether this rumor is true or not, today's march, the Millions March of November 21st, is taking place, and that the demands of the protesters are not limited to the return of the Prime Minister or his cabinet, and that they still stand by their three no's, which is no compromise, no negotiation, and no partnership with the military. One of the seven demands that were put out by the resistance committees on October 30th include a law that totally bans any interference from the military in politics, it bans any military personnel from interfering in political process while they are still in the military. And on the other side, what matters to the protesters is the path that the government will take, and a path that leads to economic justice and to criminal justice cannot be one that the military will be able to infiltrate, because it will start first by removing the investments that are under control of the military and outside the control of the Ministry of Finance and the civilian government, and bringing them back to the control of the people. These are one of the things that the protesters and the Sudanese people are asking for, to ensure that the military will no longer have the financial capability to take over the political process as they are doing right now.
Moving on, fury and reactions in the U.S. over the acquittal of a militia member who shot dead two anti-racism protesters last year. A court verdict that the shooting by Kyle Rittenhouse was in self-defense is triggering a lot of heated debate. There have been protests across several cities. In Chicago, Black Lives Matter protesters turned out carrying signs that read, "White supremacy equals terrorism." Protests also erupted in Tampa, Florida, and Minneapolis, Minnesota. The verdict has raised fierce criticism of the justice system and its preferential treatment of white supremacists. There's also a renewed debate over the boundaries of gun rights and self-defense in the U.S. And scuffles break out in the Netherlands as protests against the government's new coronavirus restrictions continue for a second consecutive night. The latest footage shows clashes between police and protesters in The Hague. Thousands of people also took to the streets in the capital, Amsterdam, despite the strong presence of security forces. This follows an outbreak of violence on Friday night in Rotterdam. Three people were injured in the city after police fired shots and water cannons to disperse angry demonstrators. Dozens of people were also arrested. Similar anti-lockdown protests were also held in other European countries on Saturday, including Denmark, Croatia, and Austria.
Tens of thousands take to the streets of the Austrian capital ahead of the nation's fourth general lockdown, affecting the vaccinated and unvaccinated alike.
This is just one of several rallies taking place across the city just the day after the government announced that vaccinations will become mandatory from February.
Around 2 million of the country's 9 million residents have refused to get vaccinated.
I've not been vaccinated, and I believe this is a bluff on the part of the government. They want to put people under pressure. When vaccination becomes mandatory, I will stay at home. I believe everyone should be able to make their own choice.
I'm here because I'm against the vaccination for everybody. I want to decide myself. It's my body. And so I don't want to tell anyone to me that I have to go to vaccination.
The federal government has blamed the right-wing opposition Freedom Party, the FPÖ, for fueling public anger at a time of national crisis. Police forces confirmed that right-wing extremists, including convicted neo-Nazis, had taken part in the rallies, which remained largely peaceful, despite several instances of clashes and arrests. Austria is now reporting well over 15,000 new infections a day, with the total death toll almost reaching 12,000 people. Health experts say without compulsory vaccinations, the country will only stumble into new lockdowns every 3 or 4 months. Homaleski, Vienna.
Moving on, the International Organization for Migration says the situation still remains tough for migrants stranded on the border between Belarus and Poland. The organization's chief of mission in Belarus says migrants still have no access to basic living standards despite an improvement in their conditions. Thousands of migrants have been camping for weeks on the Belarusian side of the border with Poland. They are trying to cross into the European Union, but Poland blocks their entry. Warsaw accuses Minsk of fomenting the crisis, a claim Belarus denies. Minsk started repatriating some of the migrants to Iraq Thursday. And the row over Taiwan now is expanding to Europe. China says it is downgrading its diplomatic relations with Lithuania after the Baltic state allowed Taipei to open its de facto embassy in the capital. Foreign Ministry says that Beijing has to lower its ties to safeguard China's sovereignty and the basic norms of the international relations. It added that the Lithuanian government must bear all the consequences that arise from this decision. Lithuania has reacted, expressing regret over Beijing's decision. Back in July, Lithuania allowed for the opening of the embassy, Taiwan's first new diplomatic outpost in Europe in 18 years. With that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome back to Aperture. The illegal recycling of electronics is a toxic business on a global scale. Every year, three-quarters of electronic waste from Europe and the U.S. disappears from official recycling system and is shipped illegally to India, China, or Africa. In the first part of the documentary, we took you on an investigative journey through Africa, China, Europe, and the U.S. in an effort to unravel the out-of-control corrupt systems enabling illegal e-waste recycling. Stay with us as we further investigate to reveal the apparatus of large-scale trafficking as well as a complex chain of responsibility and collusion in the next part of the program.
The U.S. is the only country in the world, apart from Haiti, that has not ratified the Basel Convention, the international agreement banning the export of toxic waste. To make matters worse, the U.S. government itself is as bad as anyone else when it comes to recycling its own discarded equipment.
The U.S. government is the single biggest producer of electronic waste on the planet.
Discarded electronics of whole departments are routinely put out to public auction instead of being sent to trustworthy recyclers.
Whoever gives the government the best rate, in other words, they can take it for free or almost for free, the government is kind of obliged to do that because in our laws you're supposed to go the cheapest way to save the taxpayer money. But the cheapest way is the dirtiest way.
Recyclers who do actually recycle find themselves the target of shady exporters. Plant manager Craig Lorch has been in the business for more than 20 years.
We get regular requests from brokers that are in other countries looking to buy materials, buying computers, metals, laptops, anything with valuable materials in them. We don't sell to them. We don't know what they're going to do with the materials. We don't know where it's going to go.
Craig is part of a minority of conscientious recyclers who collaborate with Jim Puckett and the Basel Action Network. But many U.S. recyclers do export. The Basel Action Network estimates that between 20 and 50 e-waste containers leave U.S. harbors every day. To find out where exactly U.S. e-waste is exported to, Jim came up with a very effective spying technique.
We will just go around to these people calling themselves recyclers, and you drive by them, and the beauty is that you can't hide a big old 40-foot container. So it's very easy to photograph them, and they have prominent numbers, and we take pictures of those, and we date them.
Jim then goes online to find out where the e-waste containers are headed.
I can type that number into a database called TrackTrace, and here we see the whole record of that particular container in its last week's voyages. It's gone from Thailand to Singapore, now to New Zealand.
Analyzing the main trading routes for U.S. e-waste, Jim made a surprising discovery.
It comes through Hong Kong almost 65% of the time from the U.S. We didn't know that till we started tracking. Wow, they're all going to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong Harbor is the third largest port in the world, and any e-waste sent by the U.S. to Asia enters through here. But why isn't it seized and returned straight to sender? ...63,000 containers arrive here every single day on merchant ships of all shapes and sizes. Vincent Wong oversees the customs team at the harbor. The biggest terminal, Kwai Sing, receives nearly 50,000 containers a day. Up to 100 of them are estimated to contain e-waste. Tracking them down is a challenge.
Hong Kong is a free port. That means that the ship and the cargo don't have to declare to customs at the point of entry right away, except they are demanded by customs officers. They only need to declare after 14 days, within 14 days of the import or export of a consignment.
This means that by the time Wong and his colleagues receive the customs declaration, the cargo has usually long moved on. To combat this loophole, the customs inspectors pull out any containers which ring an alarm bell. For instance, because of the company's history or a tip-off from abroad, and submit them to an X-ray scan.
We can scan a container truck in less than 2 minutes, the whole truck, and then if necessary, we'll open the container for further inspection.
E-waste has its very own shape and look under an X-ray scanner. Items like computer monitors stand out clearly.
For e-waste, we have quite a number of cases in the past few years, and most of them are declared as plastic scrap or metal scrap.
Up to 36,000 e-waste containers are estimated to enter through Hong Kong Harbour every year, enough to fill 20 of the largest cargo ships. About 40 containers a year are intercepted, sent back, and their owners prosecuted.
We do not process each and every container coming or going out of Hong Kong. Around the world, there's no one custom administration that can process 100% of them.
As a result, there are always containers that escape the authorities. Chinese activists are trying to find out what happens to them.
I always want to do something to make some change. So I joined Greenpeace since 2002. The first campaign is working on the e-waste.
Lai Yun is investigating how the e-waste containers slipping through the controls at Hong Kong get to mainland China. Just north of Hong Kong Island in the New Territories, there is a perfect hiding place for e-waste in transit. Lai Yun has come to pick up the trail.
I heard about a lot of e-waste from the overseas, like the United States, coming to Hong Kong.
He soon finds a storage yard. The e-waste shipments await transport over the border. And since the storage of e-waste is not illegal, the authorities are turning a blind eye. There are dozens of yards in this area. The site contains everything from TV sets to monitors and computers. If these, as usually claimed on customs declarations, were really exported as usable second-hand goods, they wouldn't be sitting out in the open air in the rain.
I think that China and the United States so important work together to solve the e-waste problem. This is an international issue.
From the storage yards, the e-waste is smuggled across the border into mainland China. It's just a few miles away, but it's illegal.
The trucks reload in New Territories and drive across very close, and they have to pay a bribe. It's the only way they could get across. Or you use a small coaster boat and go up the Pearl River Delta into areas like Nanhai. And there, again, you'd pay a bribe to unload it.
Once the e-waste has crossed the border, it travels to places like the town of Guiyu.
When we went to the Guiyu, we don't see any signs to say, okay, this is Guiyu. But we just smell, very strong, the smell. Okay, we know we arrived at Guiyu.
Guiyu is one of many Chinese towns and villages where illegal e-waste recycling is happening on an industrial scale. of the population are involved, processing millions of tons of e-waste a year with the connivance of the industrialized nations. The owners of the yards buy the waste abroad for peanuts, then recycle it using cheap labor. No money is spent treating the toxic leftovers or protecting the workers, so an item can be recycled for a tenth of the cost charged in Europe or the US. As opposed to the African dump sites, in Guayu, there is a division of labor.
Very typical local family workshop. The workers also recycle the plastic or CRT. This guy used the light to burn the plastic and classify different steps.
Separating different kinds of plastic by burning and smelling them is a cheap and effective technique, but it damages the lungs. Another family workshop specializes in recovering minute amounts of gold by dipping motherboards into acid baths. The workers are risking cancer by breathing in the toxic smoke. Afterwards, the remaining acid is simply dumped in the river. The groundwater has also been polluted, and even a simple cup of tea is laced with toxins. The constant exposure to substances such as PCBs, lead, and mercury is causing numerous health problems, including nerve and brain damage, skin diseases, and a rise in birth defects.
Really, what's happening is people are externalizing costs. You don't want to solve the problem, you'd rather let someone else deal with it, and you'll never have to pay for it. You don't ever get a bill from China saying, you contaminated my land, you have to pay.
China's factories in the neighboring provinces, for instance in Shanghai, Yangzhou, and Guangdong, immediately buy up any recycled materials, such as copper, aluminium, iron, gold, and plastics. But e-waste recycling is not only about selling scrap materials. An even more lucrative business is the recycling of computer chips. In clandestine workshops, transistors, integrated circuits, and other components are taken off discarded motherboards. The harvested parts are sorted and cleaned and sold as brand new components for the production of new electronics. This trade is said to be worth 100 billion euros a year, but it carries a huge risk that has an impact all over the globe, wherever computer chips are a part of our lives. For instance, in trains, planes, cars, nuclear power plants, hospitals, in short, everywhere. The companies who build the control systems for this kind of equipment are finding it increasingly difficult to distinguish between new chips and refurbished ones, and to be sure that their products on which many lives depend are safe. For TQ Systems in Germany, this is a daily challenge. Since the original label has been painted over, it's hard to know which type of chip it really is. Clues pointing to the origin of a chip on the scrap heap are broken and missing pins, or labeling that has been scratched off with a crude and blunt instrument. If the chips were sold as new, they should have come from a factory like this facility in Dresden, where new chips are produced in a highly controlled environment. But the scratched surfaces point to a different origin. Guayu, or another e-waste recycling village somewhere in the developing world. And this means that the chips might be damaged. Major chip manufacturers have started to employ investigators to keep tabs on the situation.
We're currently investigating a case where a customer had purchased from the open market a power module. They introduced them into a public transportation system, and after 1 month of usage, they exploded.
The module had burnt out inside. Stephen Jetta and his team found out that it had been fraudulently relabeled with a higher temperature resistance, probably because a high resistance fetches a better price.
You can imagine if you have a power module that's originally developed in an environment where maximum voltage is 1200 voltage, and it's been remarked in 2400 voltage, it's not going to last.
TQ Systems have decided to check every single batch of chips on arrival using a special X-ray system. paid time and effort to find out if the skewed connection is harmless or likely to cause a malfunction. Mike is back in Ghana and observing a steady stream of containers arriving from all over the world. Why do the Ghanaian authorities not seize the e-waste on arrival and only let in the functional second-hand goods? A young Ghanaian investigator, Anas Aramayo, has some answers. Anas always works undercover and has never shown his face in public. He recently took his hidden camera to Tema Harbor, Ghana's main port.
E-waste was one of the biggest areas that we looked into. For example, most fraud happened through the e-waste system. Customs have a form of valuation for such home appliances or goods, and the valuation is next to nothing. Somebody goes to clear used goods from the West, and they will look at it as condemned goods, so you are not going to pay the value that you would pay ordinarily.
At Tema Harbor, no one is really interested in separating working goods from waste. Everything is declared as waste and let in virtually tax-free, with the help of a bribe, or a little present for the customs officers.
In many of my footage, you see the SEPS officers walking through the e-waste. First of all, they themselves start picking some that they think is useful.
Then the importers sell the material. The working items go to the second-hand market, the rest to the scrap dealers. For the buyers, it's a gamble, as up to 90% can be broken or in need of repairs.
There was nothing like anybody's going to check the efficacy. In fact, at the sales point, you are told that this is it. It may have a fault or not. For example, if you take about 30 of them, the ones that will be working well will be about 2 or 3. But then the people who buy also rely on doing some repair work on it.
The items that work or can be repaired go on sale in the streets of Accra.
Majority of Ghanaians, about 90% of Ghanaians, would want to depend on these second-hand equipment. So there are new phones, there are new laptops, but it is still expensive and people don't have the money to afford these things.
The second-hand market is thriving. A functional 10-year-old computer, siphoned off the recycling system in Europe or the US, trades for 25 euros upwards. But there is a big problem with imported second-hand equipment. Often it has only a very short lifespan left.
We should control not only the waste, but the near end-of-life equipment, so things that become waste really quickly.
Ghana doesn't have any recycling facilities, so any equipment coming into the country, be it e-waste to be scrapped, new electronics, or second-hand imports, sooner or later ends up on a dump site. Ironically, many of the old appliances will have been officially charged to the recycling system in Europe before being exported. But the ones doing the actual recycling work are a group of kids who eke out a living selling the small amounts of metal they can recover. This can hardly be called efficient recycling. All this raises a seemingly naive question. Given that when we buy a new computer in Europe, its recycling is included in the purchase price, shouldn't this money end up with the person doing the actual recycling, wherever they may be on the planet? If European e-waste continues to go abroad, shouldn't the European recycling system be extended and used to set up modern recycling plants in places like Ghana? Or what about a totally different approach? While harbor controls fail to prevent the e-waste from entering, while broken electronics are traded freely on the internet, while e-waste travels the seas by the container load, while Europe and the US won't stop the ships from leaving, while recycling facilities in Europe are leaking like sieves to shady brokers. We need to remember who is at the start of the e-waste chain. The consumer. Few of us can resist the latest gadgets, and we have got into the habit of constantly replacing them with the latest model after a very short time. Last year, worldwide, nearly 50 million flat panel TV sets were sold, 300 million PCs, and 2 billion mobiles and smartphones. Sales figures for consumer electronics are constantly on the rise, and not only in Europe, but also in emerging markets such as India, China, and Africa. Maybe it's time to redefine our roles as consumers and start using our gadgets for a longer time, before the entire planet is littered with discarded appliances that have a long and toxic life ahead of them as e-waste.
Perhaps it's important for the consumers to be aware of how overconsumption and subsequent illegal dumping causes suffering to other human beings across the globe. Perhaps this will lead to more responsible choices, but the bottom line is that governments in the EU and the US must take full responsibility by putting better regulations and systems in place. This toxic tide plaguing the world cannot be stopped while so many governments in the developed world are willing to turn a blind eye. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. Truly, it's a blessing and an honor to be with you guys, share these moments of enlightenment and these little reminders that can act as beacons for us through the day and to help us get through perhaps moments of darkness and doubt that we might be experiencing through the natural course of life. One of the most pivotal concepts in Islam is the concept of tawakkul, reliance on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's a very deep and meaningful concept that truly engulfs every aspect of our lives. And however, sometimes it can get a little tricky. And if we're not careful, and if we're not well informed, well educated about this concept, this notion of tawakkul, we can very easily misinterpret it and blur the lines between relying on Allah and being a potato. Let's listen to a short story regarding this matter to get a better idea of what we're talking about, and we're going to be right back.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Merciful, dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners of this program, Lantern, so welcome. I invite you to listen to our today's story. Once there lived a lazy farmer who did not enjoy working hard in the fields. He spent his days napping on the tree. One day, while he was resting under a tree, a fox came chasing a rabbit. There was a loud thump. The rabbit had crashed into the tree and died. The farmer picked up the dead rabbit and took it home, frustrating the hell out of the fox. The farmer cooked and ate the rabbit for dinner and sold its fur at the market. The farmer thought to himself, if I could get a rabbit like that every day, I'd never work again. The next day, the farmer went right back to the tree and waited for another rabbit to die in a similar way. He saw a few rabbits, but none of them ran into the tree like before. Indeed, it was a very rare incident, but the farmer did not recognize it. Oh well, he thought cheerfully, there is always tomorrow. Since he was just waiting for the rabbit to hit a tree and die, he did not give any attention to his field. Weeds grew in his rice field. Soon the farmer had to be hungry, as he ran out of his rice and never caught any other rabbit too. Moral of the story, do not wait for good things to come without doing anything. Do not give your life to luck without working for success.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So this anecdote is very similar to a lot of ahadith and the riwayat that we might hear about the time of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam or any other a'imma alayhi salam, and how they were told that, you know, so-and-so person is just sitting around at home, perhaps even doing nothing but worship, praying and doing tahajjud and fasting during the day and holding nightly vigils during the night and not working and not trying or not doing, putting any effort into making ends meet and putting bread on the table and supporting their family or gaining knowledge or any of that. Like, if I sit on my hands and I pray to God, I want a house and I want a career and I want an education and I want a good car and, you know, I want to see the world, I want to be successful, or even I want to have a lot of knowledge and I want to be a scholar, and I want to write a lot of books and contribute to Islam and this and that, but I don't do anything. And I say, well, I'm just going to rely on God. I'm going to have tawakkul on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and He's going to sort it out for me. I'm just going to sit here without engaging in any sort of material actions and means, and, you know, wait for someone to knock on my door tomorrow morning and tell me, well, Zainab, here's your car, and here's your house, and here's your degree, and here's your ijtihad, and here's your risala too, while we're at it, and go, you've officially saved the world because your prayers were that sincere. There has to be action put into it, and there has to be effort, and we have to strive, and we have to thrive, and we have to prove to God that we really want this by acting. Something else that I find or people who ask about the concept of tawakkul and relying on God and, you know, how to create that balance is in regard to our ties. Now, we know people in society naturally. We're social creatures, so they say. We have ties, we have bonds, we know people, family members, relatives, distant cousins, colleagues, acquaintances, people who can, you know, get our work done. And does that in any way contradict with the notion of tawakkul? And is that some sort of, you know, ascribing a partner to Allah in achieving the goal and objective that we have our eyes on? Well, we could think of it this way. Everything that comes on our path toward reaching that goal was sent there by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You know the famous story? I heard it first on the movie Pursuit of Happiness. I didn't watch that movie because it's a little too sad for my taste, but I heard this quote there first, that a person was drowning and the first boat and the second boat and the third boat came to save them, and every time the boats came he said, no, it's okay, God will save me. And then he died, and then he was like, God, why didn't you save me? And then God was like, well, I sent you three boats, silly. Basically, Allah isn't gonna, you know, stick his hand down from heaven. Not that God only resides in heaven, but he's not going to directly stick his hand into our business and sort things out for us and let us sit there and watch, right? He's going to send means and people and middlemen and mediums and tools. And if we approach those facilities and equipments that we have with this sort of viewpoint, that everything that exists is existing because Allah wants it there, and Allah wants it there to help me achieve whatever it is that I want to get, then that will furthermore support the tawakkul and reliance that we have on God. That's basically what it means. It means that we don't recognize a material matter as something independent of God and something that possesses independent will and power to aid us. There's no independence. Tawakkul on Allah is understanding that everything in this universe is in a state of absolute need and poverty toward Allah. Everything relies on God in its existence, in its survival, in its continuation, and in its effects. Tawakkul on Allah is understanding that and realizing and acknowledging that if Allah doesn't will for a certain thing to serve me, then it will not be able to do so, no matter how much I try. No matter how much I lie and I steal and I oppress people and I kill and I usurp, at the end of the day, it's going to backfire on me sooner or later. And karma is going to come and bite me in the neck. That's what tawakkul means. It means that even if I've got all the money and all the resources to serve me, I understand deeply and truly with certainty and conviction that God placed those things for me, and God can take it away from me whenever he wills. And once I understand that, once I have a deep understanding of that, everything I do will have a tawhidi, a monotheistic energy to it, and every act will be an act of worship. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.